Hello, everyone. Hello, Cheryl. happy Sunday. Let's see, today's what, the 27th day of January. So January 2013 is just on its way out, which is incredible to me. We are here for the seven steps to awakening. And tonight we're going to start with quote number 468. So what I'm going to do, of course, is share a link with you all. For anyone who is listening on the radio, in order to join us in my journal, you can go to RDA7. That is the digit 7. It is not spelled out. RDA7stepsjournal.wordpress.com. And both on the menu bar at the top and also on the menu on the right side of the screen, what you can do is locate step 2. And then underneath step 2, locate the numbering sequence that will allow you to find your way to 468, because that is where we are going to begin, with 468. Before we do that, I would like to take a moment of silence. Amen. All right, so I'm going to do what I always do. I'm going to first read the quote from the book, The Seven Steps to Awakening, and then we will look at my journal entry. My journal entry is what I wrote after contemplating the quote that I will be reading. The quote originally is from the Supreme Yoga, Yoga Vasistha, and this is the first quote. There is no such thing as earth or matter. There is no such thing as earth or matter. So if you look at my journal, you'll find what I wrote after contemplating this quote. Oh, this is a good question. This is a very, very good question. The question that came up for me after contemplating the quote is the desire for truth, or is the desire for world experience? One cannot have both. So this question must be sincerely and deeply considered. Lately, one of the voices that I've been listening to a little bit this month is Adyashanti. And I hadn't really listened to him previously. But one of the things that I've certainly heard him emphasize is the importance of desiring truth simply for truth's sake. And in fact, as I just now said this, I remembered that I did a teaching on this on Thursday, the original edition teaching that I did, which was the end of one chapter and the beginning of another chapter. I don't even remember which chapters now. I'm not good at the remembering game. But I remember I talked about this. And when I did the teaching on Sunday, I told you that when my friend Tristan was here from Australia, he had showed me a little Adyashanti clip. And this would have been back a couple of years ago. And that in that clip, Adyashanti was really emphasizing that you seek truth for truth's sake. Well, by coincidence, on Friday morning, I sat down to listen to a recording that a friend sent to me. I probably listened to 20, 25 minutes of this recording. And in the 20 or 25 minutes that I listened, this again, it was again Adyashanti, and he was again emphasizing this. So it was emphasized through my teaching on Thursday. It was emphasized through my listening on Friday. And now through my teaching, it's showing up again to be emphasized. One of the things I talked about in my teaching on Thursday was there's a difference between seeking what we call enlightenment or seeking awakening or even seeking truth because of a particular quality that we expect from it. And in fact, in NTI Luke, there's a place where the Holy Spirit says something about, you know, what is it that you expect of me? And Holy Spirit really points out that anything that we expect of God, of Holy Spirit, of truth, of awakening, of enlightenment, is based on a limited imagination that could not possibly imagine what truth is. And Holy Spirit goes on to say something like, I can't remember the exact words, but the idea is, I hope you do not fail because of what you imagine truth is. And of course, that's just Holy Spirit's way of encouraging us to let go of our imagination of what truth is. Sometimes I think that we think that when we are enlightened or awake or wholly healed, that everything we want will come easily. And that's the quality that we seek from truth. Sometimes we think we will know all things, you know, all things of form. We will know everything. And that's the quality we seek. Sometimes we think, the body will be perfectly healed, or we will be able to heal others. Maybe we think we will be able to know the future. Maybe we think we will be able to know other people's thoughts. And these might be qualities that we seek. Sometimes we think that, you know, maybe we can have experiences like today when I was walking my dog and she was sniffing. You know, if I wanted to know what she was sniffing and what images this created for her in her mind, if any, or what information was going into her brain as she sniffed, you know, that I would be able to kind of merge with my dog and have her experience, or merge with a flower and have it its experience. And so this merging quality is what I seek. But if you look very carefully at all of these qualities, all of these ideas we might have about what enlightenment it is, or about what awakening is, or what truth is, every one of those qualities are based on an experience we want to have in the world. And that's not the same as seeking truth for truth's sake. It's really kind of like seeking truth so I can get something from it. And the encouragement that I hear from Adyashanti, the encouragement I heard from A Course in Miracles on Thursday, and the encouragement that I hear now in this journal is to seek truth simply for truth's sake. Not to desire anything specific from it, not to have any expectations of it. And in fact, like I said in NTI, although I don't remember the exact quote at all, but the idea was something like, I hope you do not fail because of your expectations of me, meaning Holy Spirit, meaning truth. And this kind of puts forth the same idea that you can't have both. Both these qualities you seek as a part of world experience and the truth. And it says, so this question must be sincerely and deeply considered. What is it that you truly want? To merge with a dog or to know truth, right? To be able to heal others or be healed yourself, or to know truth above all else? What do you desire? And the idea here is if you desire some experience more than truth, you might even be able to attract or manifest that experience without yet knowing truth. because that was not your desire. All right, so I'm going to scroll down now underneath 468 and click on number 469. Of course, you're welcome to join me in that. I'm also going to put a link to 469 in the room because I notice our friend Jay has joined us. I'll start by reading 469 in the Seven Steps to Awakening. Duality, or diversity, is false. The one mass of infinite consciousness alone is real. Again, duality or diversity is false. The one mass of infinite consciousness alone is real. Some people may wonder why the recommendation is to desire truth just for truth's sake, just because you want to know what truth is what I mean by that, without desiring a specific quality of truth. The reason for that really is because the I that is desiring the specific quality, the I that is desiring a specific awakened or enlightened experience, is a separated I. And you can't have that I and have non-duality too. Because that I that would experience, or the I that desires to experience merging into the dog, the I that desires experiencing healing others or being healed itself, the I that desires all of this still sees everything as separate from it. And in fact, that's why it desires these qualities or these experiences. It's an I want because I will be more fulfilled type of thought. And so because you are desiring an experience of separation, you can't also have the truth, because the truth is not this experience of separation. So it's one or the other. You desire truth just because you want to know truth, or you desire to have experiences. 469 again says duality or diversity is false. So you can see that if you're going for the experiences and there's an I experiencing something, that falls into that realm of duality or diversity, and it's false. Therefore, it's not truth. This quote continues, "The one mass of infinite consciousness alone is real." So let's look at 469 in my journal. What do I find interest in when looking at the world? Now, for those of you who are joining me this week but weren't here last week while going through my journal, what we discovered was that there was an error in my mind. And the error was that there was still an attraction and an attachment, both an attraction and attachment, toward the future, in being excited about discovering what would happen next. Just, you know, what will happen next? And it was pointed out that that is actually an error. And in fact, I read a quote from the Supreme Yoga, Yoga Vasistha, where he explained that he found the same error in his mind too at one point. He said that he saw many universes, you know, as he was becoming more and more awakened. He could have these experiences that maybe we crave as world experience. He was able to somehow travel within himself and see many universes. And he says that their diversity aroused his curiosity. And he said he wanted to roam more and see more of the magnitude of creation. You know, so see how this is a desire for an experience beyond the world, in this case, of the universe. He had accumulated this special power, we could call it, and he was really enthralled by it. But then he says after some time, he abandoned that idea because he realized it was a delusion. It was in the realm of false instead of truth. And instead of being curious and wanting to see all of these other worlds, which he could do, he had developed that power. What he wanted instead was to stay aware of the infinite consciousness itself. And it was through that desire to simply stay aware of the infinite consciousness itself and not travel in the world through, you know, through his mind experience, that he awoke. And so again, I realized that my desire, oh, I wonder what'll happen next. Oh, I wonder what'll happen next. Oh, I wonder what'll happen next, was really focused on the world. And I realized that it was an error. It wasn't the same as being focused on only awareness or only presence. It was being focused outwardly. So this may be the same day or the next day, but this is very close to the discovery of that error. And so that's what this question is related to. Remember, the quote we're looking at is the one that says duality or diversity is false. The one mass of infinite consciousness alone is real. So in contemplating that quote, I entered into an inquiry, and the inquiry said, what do I find interest in when looking at the world? What is arousing my curiosity, my excitement? And I found that it was change. Not knowing what will happen and having interest or curiosity to discover what the change will be. That's, at this point, that's what the interest was that was keeping my eyes towards the world. The question that came next was, is change reality? And the answer to that, of course, is no. Reality is changeless, and changeless is reality. So the next question came, so is interest currently placed more with reality or illusion? And I had to, of course, admit that interest was currently placed more with illusion. If I was anticipating the future, wanting to know what would happen in the story next. And again, what was interesting about this is I, up until this error was discovered in my mind, I actually thought this was a somewhat enlightened point of view. Because I was not fearing the future, I was not worrying about the future, I had no attachment to a specific outcome. It didn't matter to me, you know, which way it went. I was just curious about it and excited. And so, of course, if you compare that curiosity, that excitement about what will happen next without attachment to outcomes, without fear or worry, it seems somewhat enlightened by comparison. And I'm sure when Yoga Vasistha was able to travel in his mind and see many, many universes, that was somewhat enlightened by comparison to the way to his experience before. You know, I'm reminded of Muji's story of the yogini, which is a story I told a few times at the beginning of my Seven Steps teaching around a year ago. The yogini sat in meditation asking the question, who am I? Inquiry was her practice. And I don't remember the details now of the story, but it's something like as she sat in meditation, she saw light beings or something, you know. And many people would become excited by such an incredible spiritual experience to have light beings visiting them in the meditation and sharing wisdom with them. But the yogini was not impressed. She just continued to ask, who am I? And she began to focus her attention on the presence to which these light beings appeared. And again, I don't remember how the story goes. I think next she actually may have seen colors, these incredible colors, colors that were not even of the world. They're colors that we do not see with our physical eyes, completely new colors. And most people would be amazed by such an experience in meditation. They would think, oh my God, I had this incredible experience. I saw these gorgeous colors that we don't even have in the world. But the yogini was not impressed. Instead, she focused on the awareness to which these colors appeared. And continued to ask the question, who am I, knowing that she was that awareness. And then, if I remember correctly, the next thing that came were sounds, incredible sounds. Again, not of this world, beautiful, beautiful sounds. And again, the yogini was not impressed. She continued to focus on the awareness that these sounds were appearing to. What all of this is saying is that the error that we make, even as you could say we are awakening, I mean, you know, the experience of not being attached to a certain outcome in the future, not being worried about the future, just being curious, feels enlightened compared to an earlier time when there was worry, there was attachment to an outcome, you know, wanting things to work out a certain way, trying to manipulate it. It feels very enlightened. But it is still a way of focusing on the world. It's like yogini being excited by the colors. And it's like yoga vasistha for a time being excited by the many universes. And what's being pointed out here is that this excitement is still an object focus. It's still focus on the illusion and not the truth. And so no matter what appears to us, no matter how spiritual or divine the objects seem to become, or our point of view seems to become as we awaken, we do not want to be taken in by that. We want to remain focused on the changeless awareness. The changeless awareness is not excited to find out what happens next. The changeless awareness simply is. And yes, it will still be simply is no matter what happens next. But it doesn't have that forward-looking curiosity. You see, the forward-looking curiosity is still human or ego or mind. So what do I find interest in when looking at the world? Well, at the point when this was written, I was discovering that I had interest in the change. And then the inner wisdom through questioning reminded me that change is illusion. It is not reality. And so if I'm interested in the change, curious about the change, my attention is still focused on illusion. And of course, this was something I definitely needed to see if I wanted to truly awaken to truth. I needed to see where, in a subtle way, I was holding on to illusion. All right, so we can scroll down and click on number 470, which I will also post in the room. I see a few people have shown up since the last time I shared a link. First, I will read number 470 from the Seven Steps to Awakening. This is still the Yoga Vasistha. There is no such thing as the world. Very simple comment. There is no such thing as the world. All right, let's look at 470 in my journal and see what I wrote after contemplating this comment. If the world does not exist, then I, this person in a world, cannot exist either. If I see through inquiry and investigation that I cannot prove the world exists, aren't I also saying that I cannot prove I exist? Now, I in this case meaning the person, the personality. Now, again, for any of you who have paid attention as I've been going through this inquiry for months now, you know that there have been several times when I have seen very clearly that although the world appears before me, I cannot prove that it exists, which to some people would sound crazy because, you know, if I hold up this red cup of water and say, Danielle, I see a red cup of water, do you? She says yes. Well, some people would say that's proof. Both you and Danielle see a red cup of water, so you got your proof. You got your proof that it's real. But what I've seen as I've gone through the inquiry is that human perception is not proof. Because, first of all, human perception is so incredibly flawed. Plus, human perception goes through a mind and then goes through a body and through senses like sight and touch. So it kind of has middlemen, you could say. You know, there's the filter of the mind, and then the filter of the senses and an interpretation that occurs. There's not a direct experience. It's an indirect experience. And if there is an indirect experience, there is reason to doubt that the experience is pure or true. And if there is doubt that the experience is pure or true, then there is no proof that what is experienced is actually what it is. In addition to that, I have had experiences, and some of you know this, that really bring into question the idea that this is a red cup with water in it. I have had the experience of, you'll remember, being an apple when my awareness shifted into an apple. And as an apple, I had sight, spiritual sight, rather than physical sight, because I don't have eyes. But I saw that all there was at the level of form was light. There was a compacted light which made up all objects, and more of a spatial light that made up all space, but all there was light. There was no cup of water. There was no body. There was just light. And then I also had those experiences in China where I felt incredible love, divine love, coming to me from a towel rack and from a floor. So through my own experiences, I have lots of reason to doubt the indirect experience of perception. And then on top of that, what the inquiry that I've gone through with the seven steps has reinforced and reinforced is that there is one thing that I know for sure, one thing that is not open to interpretation, and that I call isness. Some people call it beingness. Some people call it awareness. Some people call it presence. Some people call it existence. But the one thing that I can confirm, I cannot confirm that I am a person named Regina. I can't confirm that. But I can confirm that I exist. Whether I seem to be a person named Regina, or whether I seem to be an apple in the moment, the common denominator was the existence, the awareness, the presence. That's the only direct experience. That knowledge is true knowledge, not open to any interpretation. So as I go through this inquiry and I see again and again that I cannot confirm the world is real, that of course also means I cannot confirm that the person of Regina is real. The entire thing could be, and again, we're not talking about studying a book here. I know the books teach they are illusion, but here this is an inquiry and a direct experience learning. The entire thing could be illusion because it cannot be proven to exist like isness can be proven. There's no direct experience of the little self or of the world. So number 470, If the world does not exist, then I, this person in a world, cannot exist either. If I see through inquiry and investigation that I cannot prove the world exists, aren't I also saying that I cannot prove I exist? Again, that's not referring to existence, it's referring to the body, personality, mind. Existence is not questionable. But what am I? That's still a valid question. All right, moving on to 471. Again, you can scroll down and click on the 471 underneath the comment and reply area, or you can use the link that I am posting in the room now. Number 471, first from the book, The Seven Steps to Awakening, quoting Yoga Vasistha. This body, so here Yoga Vasistha would be pointing at or touching the body that people would perceive to be his, right, while talking. This body is but pure void. It seems to exist on account of the mental conditioning. When the latter ceases, meaning the mental conditioning ceases, the body ceases to be seen or experienced, just as the dream object is not experienced on waking up. So, of course, this is a teaching that we're very much aware of. It's a core teaching in A Course in Miracles, that the body is not real, the body does not now, nor has it ever existed. Of course, Yoga Vasistha came centuries before A Course in Miracles. And he's saying the exact same thing. This body is but pure void. Also, we know that scientists now say the same thing, don't they? Don't they say, as they get into quantum physics and they look at smaller and smaller atoms and things that they believe were the smallest objects of matter, that when they look at the smallest objects of matter they can find, they find that they're made up of space, that the smaller they're able to see, what they find is nothing. This body is but pure void. It seems to exist on account of the mental conditioning. When the latter ceases, the body ceases to be seen or experienced, just as the dream object is not experienced on waking up. All right, let's look at my journal 471 and see what I wrote after contemplating this. All right, 471 says, background thoughts combined with the seeing and believing loop are the cause of an apparent world and apparent self. All right, so for again, I see some people in the room that maybe have never been in the room when I taught before, and so you might be jumping in on the middle of this. Anyone who is familiar with my teaching will be very familiar with what I'm about to say because I talk about it a lot. The seeing-believing loop is, again, I'll go ahead and type it out as I always do. The seeing-believing loop is what I think I see. And see here is the same as perceive. What I think, I perceive. What I see, I experience. What I experience, I think. And this creates what is called a seeing-believing loop. So, for example, if I think I am unworthy, if I have doubts about myself, my worth, and I think I am unworthy, then I am going to perceive myself as unworthy in some way. Maybe as a small child, I want to get my mother's attention. My mother is trying to cook dinner or something. And, she kind of says in a snappy way, I don't have time now, go play. And for me, I'm now perceiving how unworthy I am that my own mother won't give me attention, right? This is how I take it, because I was already thinking about my unworthiness in some way. And now with my mother's reaction to my tugging on her apron. I now seem to think that I see that I see it, I perceive it, there's evidence. And then I crawl away with an experience of unworthiness, feeling very, very unworthy, feeling lower than the kitchen floor that I'm crawling on. And then I continue to, in my own infant way, worry about whether my mother loves me. And at some point, I see again that she doesn't. And it just keeps reinforcing itself. This is the seeing-believing loop. Now, some of the seeing-believing loop is specific to a personality. So, for example, there could be things that, I have here in the room with me now, Danielle and Jasmine and I, three people. There could be things that I perceive in the world and believe about the world that Danielle and Jasmine do not. There could be things that Danielle perceives and believes about the world that Jasmine and I do not. And there could be things that Jasmine perceives about the world that Danielle and I do not. So some of this seeing and believing can seem to be a part of the personality code, you could say. And those differences are easy to pick out. It's easy to tell when someone else is believing something and experiencing it, and it has nothing to do with your experience. For example, you know, if someone else was to believe in, let's say, evil spirits. I used to have a friend who really believed in evil spirits. And he would wake up on some mornings not feeling like himself, and he would believe that an evil spirit had got into him in the nighttime, possessed him. And then he would call up this person he knew that could exorcise the spirit, and over the telephone, you know, have a session and have the spirit exorcised. And this happened to him, you know, several times. Of course, I've never had an experience of being possessed by an evil spirit, but I have no belief in that. So when someone has a belief that's very, very different from yours, sometimes it's even easy to see that they're really just making it up. But there are some beliefs that we all share. They're common. They're not personality specific. They're a part of the ego baseline, and all personalities have them. And that's where it gets a little bit harder to tell the difference between what is false and what is true. Because for the most part, all humans agree that these beliefs are true when in fact they aren't. They're still a part of the seeing-believing loop. So, if we go back to my journal with that bit of explanation and we look at 471, these background thoughts that it's referring to, these are thoughts that all people have. Unless, of course, they're awakened beings, but then they wouldn't really perceive themselves directly as a person. Anyone who perceives themselves directly as a person has these beliefs, so they appear as facts. Those are the background thoughts, the background of the seeing-believing loop. So background thoughts combined with the seeing and believing loop are the cause of an apparent world and an apparent self. Background thoughts include, so here is things that we all believe until we transcend these beliefs. The first one is, I am this. You know? Yeah. I am this, Regina. Jasmine, who are you?
I am this, Jasmine.
Danielle, who are you?
I'm Miss Danielle.
Do you all agree that you have that belief?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. And most people never question that belief. The next background belief is, I am not that. You know, I'm not that Jasmine over there. She is. I'm not that Danielle over there. She is. Neither of them think they're me. None of us believe we're this red cup with water in it. Right? I'm this. I'm not that. This is my world. At some level, no matter how much we like or dislike the world, at some level, most humans do feel like this is my world. This is where I belong. I was born into this world. You know, that's just the way it is. This blank is mine, and it has more value than that which is not mine. So, for example, this Chinese girl, I even tease her because her name is Jasmine, but it's spelled J-A-S-M-I-N-E. And for those of you who don't know, I adopted her. She's my daughter. So this Chinese girl is mine, Jazz, mine. I tease her. That's why I gave her that name. She is mine. The girl that I heard about on the news today who was kidnapped or killed or injured is not mine. And although I feel for the family and what happened to her, it is not as upsetting to me as if it happened to Jasmine. You see, what is mine has more value to me than that which is not mine. And pretty much all humans have that belief. It is a belief. It is not truth. But we experience it. So these background beliefs are constantly reinforced. I am this, I am not that, this is my world, and this blank is mine and has more value to me than that which is not mine. Because background thoughts project as body world experience, remember the loop that I typed in the room, what I think I see or perceive. So even if we just take one of these, if I think I am this, I am going to continually perceive I am this, and I'm going to experience myself as that, as this. If I think I am not that, now I'm holding up a magnifying glass. If I think I am not that, I'm going to continually perceive myself as not that magnifying glass. And my experience will consistently be, I am not that. Right? You see how this works? And people never question these thoughts because they're so normal. They're a part of everyday experience. They appear to be facts. But they're a projection of the seeing-believing loop. What I think, I see. What I see, I experience. What I experience, I think. They're a projection of that mental loop, which Yoga Vasistha a moment ago called mental conditioning. So because background thoughts project as body world experience, the body world experience vanishes when background thoughts are abandoned, when there no longer is a belief, I am this, when there no longer is a belief, I am not that. When that belief does not exist, when this is my world, when that belief does not exist, this is mine and it has value. When that belief does not exist, then it is no longer a part of the seeing believing loop because it does not exist. And as a result, it does not project. Therefore, the projection is not experienced. Because background thoughts project as the body world experience, the body world experience vanishes when background thoughts are abandoned. Again, Yoga Vasistha simply said, there is no such thing as the world. Watch for the appearance of these few background thoughts in any form. This is inner wisdom giving an assignment, you could say. Watch for the appearance of these few background thoughts in any form. How often do they appear? My experience is innumerable times throughout the day. If you watch the mind and the stories in the mind, no matter what the story is that the mind is telling, it is constantly emphasizing at least the first two, I am this, I am not that. That's what every single story the mind tells reemphasizes at least those first two. And there's certainly a lot of stories that tell the "this is mine" story. Watch for the appearance of these few background thoughts in any form. How often do they appear? How quickly are they given belief? My experience is, unless we are becoming adept at not giving belief through practice, they're given belief instantly. As soon as the thought shows up in some form of "I am this, I am not that," instantly there's just a belief, there's just a listening to the story, there's just a believing. Unless we're becoming experienced at knowing that these are not true, or at least trusting these are not true, there is no pause whatsoever. There is no questioning whatsoever. They're given belief immediately. In fact, the next question, is there a pause interrupting the seeing believing loop now? So, you know, of course, this is wisdom speaking to someone who is somewhat experienced, someone who has been practicing for some time. And so what wisdom is also saying is, notice when there isn't immediate belief given anymore. Notice when there is a pause. Notice when, you know, a mantra is said, or an inquiry occurs, or a remembrance of a teaching occurs, instead of instantaneous belief of a story. Notice when there's a decision not to believe a story. And then the next question, is there wisdom in the pause? It sounds like just a question, but this is so important, because when we stop the instantaneous believing and we begin to pause, there is a wisdom that is recognized. And there's a knowing that that wisdom is at least pointing toward, if not speaking of, or directly showing something that is more true than the story, than the ideas, "I am this, I am not that." And as we become more aware of the wisdom as more real, we begin to pause more. We begin to let go of belief more. And this is all moving us towards the letting go of these background thoughts, and therefore letting go of the false experience that's caused by these background thoughts. And when the false experience that is caused by these background thoughts is no more, there are no obstacles to block truth from realization. Truth can be realized when these false experiences fade. And in fact, I'll read this specific Yoga Vasistha quote again, number 471. "The body is but pure void. It seems to exist on account of the mental conditioning." When the latter ceases, when the mental conditioning ceases, or this seeing believing loop with these background thoughts ceases, the body ceases to be seen or experienced, just as the dream object is not experienced on waking up. All right, so let's scroll down underneath the comment and reply area, and we will click on number 472. Number 472 in the Seven Steps to Awakening, the Yoga Vasistha quote is, "Neither the subtle body nor the gross body is seen even in the waking state when the mental conditioning ceases." So now here it's interesting. He's talking about two types of bodies, the physical body, which he calls the gross body, but he's also referring to a subtle body, something that maybe doesn't seem to be so much form like the physical body does. And he says neither of these exist. Of course, this is a frightening thought for many people, because there are people who have accepted, of course, that the physical body is not real, but they still somehow have this feeling of I that is a personality feeling of I. That personality feeling of I is the subtle body. And they feel that the subtle body somehow continues to exist. Maybe they call it a soul, or they give it some type of name. But it feels very much like them, more me than the body. And they feel that this me must continue to exist. But Yoga Vasistha says, neither the subtle body nor the gross body is seen, meaning perceived, even in the waking state when the mental conditioning ceases. They both disappear. All right, so let's look at my journal entry after contemplating this, number 472. When I am this dies, I am this is dead. And remember, I am this is a thought or a belief. When I am this dies, I am this is dead. When the thought is gone, the thought is gone. That's what this really means. When the belief is gone, the belief no longer exists. It's gone. When I am this dies, I am this is dead. Perception, then, is different than perception was when I am this was present. And that, again, is because perception is a projection of the belief. So when I am this is present, perception, there is a person here. In what we call life, the person has a body. In what we call death, the person has a subtle body, an isness, an I about me, but it's still a distinct I. Right? We hear about people who have had these after-death experiences, and they'll say, I rose above my body, and I saw the doctor and the nurse working on me. Right? That they no longer see themselves as their body because the body's down there on the table. But yet there's still a very strong sense of an I here. I'm not the doctor. I'm not that body on the table that was me. I'm this thing here watching that, right? I'm not the table that I'm laying on, right? So there's still a me, even in what we would call death. There's still a projection of an I. When I am this is still believed. But that is the projection of the belief. When the projection does not exist, when the belief does not exist, I think I may have said the projection. When the belief does not exist, the projection also does not exist, because the projection comes from the belief. What I think, I see or perceive. When I am this dies, I am this is dead. Perception then is different than perception was when I am this was present. There is no longer a you speaking to me and me speaking to you. There is only speaking. There is no longer a sensation of leaving this place and going to another. There is only being here now. So this is not describing an experience at this point that is beyond perception. In fact, this is probably what A Course in Miracles refers to as true perception. It's a perceptual experience without the belief, I am this. And there does seem to be people in our world who do not have the I am this belief. And you'll hear them talking about their experience, describing their experience for us. And this is exactly how they describe it. There is no longer a you speaking to me. You know, you'll hear sentences like, it's just consciousness speaking to consciousness. Right? There's no longer a sensation of leaving this place and going to another. I heard a woman say the other day, I was not walking, the body was walking. And she's trying to describe this. I was not walking. You know, I do not move. But the body was walking. You know? And of course, in her experience, the body was within her. Just like a dream, an entire dream. You know, when we go to sleep at night, the entire dream is within us. There appears to be walking, or in my case, flying from one place to another. Maybe sometimes swimming from one place to another. But the truth is, there is no movement. There is no space. This is what she was describing. I am not walking. The body was walking. You know, that thing in the dream walked, but not I. I do not walk. So this experience that I walk from one place to another, that Regina is talking to Danielle, or right now Regina is speaking into a microphone, talking to friends in Pal Talk, this experience comes from the I am this background thought. And again, it seems real. I mean, Danielle and Jasmine would probably agree with me. You know, yes, you are talking into a microphone right now to friends in Pal Talk, but their perception is just as mistaken as my perception because they have those same shared beliefs. So the fact that their perception agrees with my perception does not mean that the perception is a fact. Okay, so I think we're out of time, so I'm going to play a song. And I'm going to play a song by a man named Jason Gray, and this song is called The End of Me. It's a great song, especially since we're talking about letting go of the I am this. At the very end, I'll tell you what he's saying, because sometimes it's hard to understand what you're hearing. He says, the end of me is not the enemy, right? The end of me is not the enemy. So here is Jason Gray. So I think I'm about out of time, so I'm going to turn Jason down and let go of the mic. It's been wonderful chatting with y'all. Good night. Bye.